Economists love to complain that politicians don't pay enough attention to economic incentives when they write laws. Our Planet Money team hears this criticism so often that it's taken to asking economists, how would you run things? Well, today, Hannah Jaffe-Walt introduces us to an economist who is trying to run his own economically pure society, his family.
The first opportunity Joshua Gantz had to test the power of economic incentives in a controlled environment came when his daughter Bea was 2. Joshua is an economist, an expert in incentives, talks about them all the time in the classroom at the University of Melbourne. So his daughter Bea was 2 and in diapers. Joshua wanted her not to be in diapers anymore. Bea was perfectly happy with the system that existed. So Joshua designed an incentive. Bea would receive a jelly bean every time she went to the toilet. New policy in place, Bea suddenly had to go to the toilet a lot. A few years later, her brother needed to be potty trained, and Bea, who is now 11 years old, jumped into the incentive system once again.
Oh, I remember that.
You want to say what happened when your brother was toilet training?
Well, I realized that if I helped my brother go to the toilet, I would get rewarded too. So I realized that the more that goes in, the more comes out. So I was just feeding my brother buckets and buckets of water. And yes.
That was my idea. It didn't really work out too well.
As Bea grew up, Joshua faced a new problem. She wanted things. Yo-yos, candy. She went on a tear about needing some Heelys, those shoes with wheels on them. So Joshua began to think about a new economic tool, allowance. Parents generally use allowance in 2 ways: as a reward for services provided, such as using the toilet, or, say, washing dishes or making the bed. Joshua had ruled that way out after Bea pumped her brother full of water. So the second approach to allowance is to use it as a tool to teach kids budget constraint. Joshua told Bea, okay, anything you want that is non-essential, you buy it with your own allowance.
However, that just doesn't quite occur. A child comes forward with a very nice dress that she's found in a store, and we think, oh, we agree that's nice as well, and all of a sudden the credit card's out.
If she comes forward with a dress that you don't like, then it has to go to the allowance.
Ones we don't like, then it's far more likely to go straight to the allowance.
But that seems like that gets in the way of the idea of teaching budget constraint, right? If you have arbitrary rules about what you have to pay for yourself and what your parents pay for.
It is very difficult indeed.
This, it turns out, is a problem governments in a free market face all the time. People in society want things leaders don't always like, things that harm the environment, things that are bad for society, like drugs or candy. Bea tells me her dad has a rule about candy.
If you want to buy candy with your allowance, you have to pay to your parents and 100% health tax.
Just as Joshua subsidizes dresses he likes, he taxes candy. He tried to calculate how much Bea's candy consumption would add to his health costs, for instance, increased dental visits, say, and he landed at 100%. It's a pretty hefty tax, but you know what? It worked.
That's it. I've earned no revenue from the health tax whatsoever, which is a bit of a shame, because this might have been a way to claw back the enormous allowance that she's getting.
You've never paid the health tax?
Never. I realize, well, that's just a ripoff. Why would I want the candy then?
Of course, just as people evade government regulation by crossing state lines for cigarettes or fireworks, Bea can go to her grandmother's for tax-free candy. Economists call this leakage. Parents can design their own rules, but the scarce resource of a parent, and governments for that matter too, is attention. 2-year-olds seem to have unlimited time to figure out how to use regulation to their benefit. That's something they share with, say, bankers.
When it comes down to it, the policies need constant adjustment. It's actually an issue of management rather than just setting the parameters correctly.
Joshua, still an economist and a parent, remains faithful to the idea of incentives driving behavior. But he's a little more wary about his ability to use them to get what he wants. Hannah Jaffe-Walt, NPR News, New York.
And now to another angle on man's efforts to control nature. Energy projects got a big boost, many billions of dollars, in last year's stimulus bill. And a major focus was renewable energy. But as it turns out, one of the largest segments of that market, wind power, will experience a sharp decline this year in its growth rate. Last year, 10,000 megawatts of wind power were brought online in the U.S. NPR's Jeff Brady says this year, that number likely will fall by more than half.
Out on the windy plains of eastern Colorado, Canadian company Enbridge recently held an event hosted by Senior Vice President Jim Schultz.
It's my great pleasure to welcome you all to our groundbreaking celebration for the 250-megawatt Cedar Point Wind Energy Project.
Wind power advocates wish more ceremonies like this were happening around the country. 2010 will mark the first time in 6 years that this industry's growth rate will actually decline. There are several reasons for this, but probably the biggest factor has to do with government incentives. The wind industry typically rises and falls with the passing and expiration of federal tax credits. Look at a graph of wind turbine installations, and there's a sawtooth pattern.
Sometimes high, then they drop off, then they're high, then they drop off.
George Sturzinger heads the Renewable Energy Policy Project in Washington. He says wind farms are expensive to build. When the credit markets dried up in 2008, so did the money for new projects. The White House and Congress threw the industry a lifeline in the stimulus package 18 months back in the form of investment tax credits. Right now, if you build a wind project, the government will essentially cut you a check for 30% of the cost. But that lifeline is running out of rope and scheduled to expire at the end of this year. Sturzinger says that deadline prompted a lot of activity last year.
Everybody moved their projects forward into 2009 to take advantage of it. Now people are looking at, you know, can you make it for sure by that deadline? If not, you stop.
And wait for the next government incentive to come along. Another factor at work here is the price of natural gas. It's relatively cheap now, so some utilities are choosing to build gas power plants rather than wind farms. In response, the wind industry says it needs a federal mandate, a law that would tell those utilities they have to buy more renewable forms of energy. Denise Bode is CEO of the American Wind Energy Association.
We're kind of stuck without without that long-term policy in place that sends the signal to the utilities that they need to purchase wind as part of a diversified portfolio and not just depend on traditional fossil fuels for 70% of their electricity.
President Obama has said he supports a renewable energy mandate. Getting it passed this fall is one of the wind industry's priorities as lawmakers return to Capitol Hill. It's worth stressing that we're talking about a decline in growth here. That means the wind industry is still growing this year, just not as fast as last year or the year before that. Matt Rogers was appointed to oversee stimulus projects at the Department of Energy. He says despite the blip this year, the big picture looks good.
We are well on our way to doubling U.S. renewable generation capacity in the U.S., which is what the president had committed to. So we're pretty excited about the overall pace of development.
The question now is whether that pace can be maintained. Roger says it would help to have more certainty when it comes to tax policy and other incentives. That would give investors and wind energy developers the information they need to make long-term plans instead of waiting around for the next government lifeline. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
There was a time when everything went the way of President George W. Bush. Congress was closely divided, yet in his first few years in office, his party passed bill after bill, including massive tax cuts. Soon those tax cuts expire, but Bush's legacy may gain from good timing. Democrats who denounced the tax cuts as irresponsible now face tough midterm elections, and they are divided over whether to extend all the tax cuts or just some. NPR's David Wellner begins a series on expiring tax breaks.
5 weeks after former President George W. Bush was sworn into office and inherited a record budget surplus, he addressed a joint session of Congress. In that February 2001 speech, he urged lawmakers to act swiftly on his signature campaign promise, a $1.6 trillion package of tax cuts.
I hope you'll join me in standing firmly on the side of the people. See, the growing surplus exists because taxes are too high and government is charging more than it needs. The people of America have been overcharged, and on their behalf, I'm here asking for a refund. Yeah.
Republicans cheered, but Democrats were deeply skeptical of a tax cut based on projections of a $5.6 trillion surplus over 10 years, which in fact never came about. At the time, North Dakota's Kent Conrad was ranking Democrat on the Senate Budget Committee.
This tax cut is simply too big. Number two, it is unfair. It goes primarily to the wealthiest among us. 40% of the benefit goes to the wealthiest 1% in this country.
And there was this dire warning from the leader of House Democrats, Richard Gephardt.
This is a mistake that we will pay for years to come.
The measures cut marginal rates on personal income taxes. They gradually reduced the estate tax, so it disappeared altogether this year. And in 2003, taxes on dividends and capital gains were also slashed. But Republicans had to let all those cuts expire to comply with budget and procedural rules, which is why taxation returns to pre-tax cut levels at the end of the year, unless Congress acts. Brown University congressional expert Wendy Schiller says that's put Democrats in a tough position.
By keeping them in place, you can say that you're cutting taxes. But if you let them expire, then you're absolutely vulnerable to a charge of raising taxes.
Republicans are already saying Democrats will let the biggest tax hike ever take place January 1st.
They seem to be proud of raising taxes, so we just need to make sure America knows that.
That's South Carolina Senator Jim DeMint. But here's what the White House wants America to know. President Obama is sticking to his campaign promise to permanently extend tax cuts on all household income below $250,000. The president spoke last week in the Rose Garden.
As Congress prepares to return to session, my economic team is hard at work in identifying additional measures that could make a difference in both promoting growth and hiring in the short term and increasing our economy's competitiveness in the long term. Steps like extending the tax cuts for the middle class that are set to expire this year.
Extending those so-called middle class tax cuts would cost the Treasury about $3 trillion over the next decade. Extending them for the top income tax brackets would cost another $700 billion. But Democrats say those cuts, which affect about 2% of taxpayers, should not be extended. Last month on ABC's This Week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi defended letting those tax breaks lapse.
I don't see any reason why we should renew a tax cut that only gives a tax cut to the wealthiest people in America, increases the deficit, and doesn't create jobs.
Republicans say that's a recipe for disaster. Here's the Senate's number two Republican, Arizona's John Kyle.
The question is, should you be raising taxes? The answer is no. And so if the answer to that is no, then leave the tax rates where they are.
More and more congressional Democrats are also taking that view. One of them is that earlier tax cut critic, Kent Conrad, who now chairs the Senate Budget Committee.
Because the economy continues weak, I would prefer to continue all the tax cuts, including those for the top end, but to sunset those for the top end at a time certain.
Perhaps 18 months from now, if the economy is stronger, Conrad says. But with Republicans poised to pick up seats in the midterms, other leading Democrats prefer using the clout they still have to let the tax cuts for the wealthiest lapse. When asked last month whether tax breaks for the wealthy should be extended, here's how Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus responded.
I think not at this point. It's not necessary, frankly.
Baucus says the Senate will take up the expiring Bush tax cuts later this month. That could present Republicans with a tough choice. They could reluctantly back a partial extension of the tax cuts, as proposed by Democrats, or they could block it and risk also being blamed if taxes go up January 1st. David Wellner, NPR News, The Capitol.
To see how you would fare if the tax cuts expire or are extended, go to NPR.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Melissa Block, and we begin this hour with the monthly jobs report out this morning. The government's numbers for August, unfortunately, pick up where the numbers for July and June left off. In short, that means another month of modest private sector job growth, more than offset by government job cuts. The unemployment rate rose slightly to 9.6%. President Obama spoke about the new numbers in a Rose Garden press conference.
New figures show the economy produced 67,000 private sector jobs in August, the eighth consecutive month of private job growth.
The president described it as positive news.
And it reflects the steps we've already taken to break the back of this recession. But it's not nearly good enough.
Not good enough. NPR's Tamara Keith explains why.
Since the start of the year, the private sector has created more than 700,000 jobs. Sounds pretty good, right?
It's about half what we need just to keep even.
Carl Van Horn is a public policy professor at Rutgers who specializes in workforce issues. Most economists say that to keep up with population growth, the economy needs to add about 150,000 jobs a month.
When you have this deep of a hole in the labor market, it's very hard to get back because if you just do the simple math, you would have to have months and months of job growth in the 300,000 to 500,000 people level.
Or in other words, we have a long way to go. Van Horn recently completed a nationwide survey and found 3 out of 4 Americans have either lost a job or have a close friend or family member who's lost a job. In Van Horn's case, his brother-in-law and a friend from college have both been out of work for months.
The vast majority of us have been affected, and it means that we're very pessimistic about the economy for the near term.
Which is not good for the economy.
Exactly. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
In St. Louis, Missouri, business owner Steve Schulte is watching the pessimism unfold in his sales figures.
There's got to be a demand for the products. There's got to be that consumer confidence. They're willing to start spending money in order to get the whole ball rolling.
Schulte's business is called Porta King Building Systems. They make modular rooms that are used in factories. When the nation's employment situation was at its worst, he had to lay off more than half of his employees. But then this spring, business picked up and he was able to hire 20 people. Then demand fell off a cliff. Now he's talking about layoffs again.
Here I am in the midst of saying it's about time for me to start batting down the hatches again just because of the conditions that we're presently seeing.
And with conditions like that, maybe it's not a surprise that Professor Van Horn's survey found most Americans think the economy is in recession and still will be a year from now. Economist Douglas Holtz-Aiken says the economic reality is only slightly more encouraging.
The right way to think about the U.S. economy at the moment is that it is growing. It's been growing for about a year, but it is growing at an anemic pace. And that every policy effort should be focused on raising the long-term growth rate of the U.S. economy.
But for many members of Congress facing tough elections this fall, there is only the short term. President Obama plans to offer his own ideas for generating more job growth next week. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.